Welcome to the Amal Podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Amal Podcast, where we explore the fascinating worlds of international law. Today, we are honored to have Professor Ronald Brand with us, the founding director of Pitt Law Center for International Legal Education, and an esteemed scholar in international law. He has authored over 20 influential books, represented the U.S. at the Hague Conference on Private International Law, and developed global programs in arbitration and legal education. My name is Athena, your host.
And my name is Lulu, and welcome, Professor Brand.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, to begin with, Professor Brand, international arbitration has seen significant growth as a preferred dispute resolution mechanism. While litigation remains the cornerstone of legal system worldwide, arbitration offers distinct advantages that make it particularly attractive in international disputes. Could you outline the core differences between arbitration and litigation?
Well, that question, if you read most arbitration treatises, that question is answered when you find a list of what are generally considered advantages of arbitration. And they are described as advantages because they are comparatively considered to be better in arbitration than litigation. I don't quite approach it that way. So my distinctions would be a little more basic than that. The first one of them would be jurisdiction, which is key to both. And the source of jurisdiction differs for courts and for arbitral tribunals. And there's only one source of jurisdiction for arbitral tribunals. It is consent. It thus makes arbitration always a creature of contract. That's not true about litigation. And the bases for jurisdiction in courts go far beyond consent. Of course, the comparison comes when parties in a contract engage in a choice between arbitration and litigation, and then whether it's arbitration or litigation create jurisdiction through consent. The second major difference I would suggest is one of process. Courts bring with them sovereign rules on procedure. They bring a state's rules of civil procedure. Sovereign rules of civil procedure do not apply in arbitration. Now, the lex arbitri, the procedural law at the seat of arbitration, does apply, but it often, and it normally always, is rather different from rules of civil procedure in courts. The third distinction I would make goes back to both of those, and it really is because of a focus on jurisdiction, and that is that in arbitration, it's more difficult to have multiple parties. Contracts are normally bilateral, not multilateral, but litigation is often very complex, particularly in the international realm. And quite often you need more than just the two basic parties. That is much easier in litigation because of the additional bases of jurisdiction that courts have. So even if you end up in a court as a result of a choice of court agreement, it's easier to add other parties in litigation than in arbitration. And the fourth distinction I would make, and I'll just stay with four for now, is it is one of them that's often noted as an advantage in arbitration, and that is confidentiality. Because courts are state-created, they are public institutions, and the inclination is to have information public in a public institution. Arbitration is a private process, and so the inclination is to have the matter private unless the parties agree otherwise. And so confidentiality matters. So I would say, for me, those are kind of the four basic distinctions and core differences between arbitration and litigation.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, especially when you think about the, when you think how enforceability plays such a huge role in international cases. So speaking of that, one of the big concerns in international dispute resolution is, of course, making sure that decisions are actually enforceable, and that jurisdictional conflicts don't get in the way. So how do international conventions try to tackle these issues? And how do different frameworks compare in their approach?
Well, although it had not been the case, we do now have treaties on both arbitration and on choice of court. The New York Convention from 1958 and the Hague Convention on Choice of Court Agreements from 2005. Now, there's always a delay from the time a convention is promulgated until you have a lot of parties who are contracting states to those conventions. That means that the New York Convention now has 172 parties. The Hague Convention, a little different, much smaller. Really, you have the EU and its 27 member states becoming 28 parties. And then you have nine other states as parties. So, but going specifically to your question, what are the challenges when these treaties are created? And I would suggest that the challenges come from the problems that are trying to be solved by creating a treaty. And the basic challenge for both the New York Convention and the Hague Convention are come from the law that exists for cross-border movement of judgments and arbitral awards in the absence of a treaty. And many states for judgments require a treaty in order to enforce a foreign judgment. And before the New York Convention, it was not common to enforce foreign arbitral awards. So it is through the treaty that we overcome this challenge. Now, I think it's important to note, however, that there's a second challenge. The New York Convention has an official title that is the United Nations Convention on the Recognition and Enforcement of Foreign Arbitral Awards. It refers only to awards in the title, but notably, and just as important, it is the Convention on Recognition and Enforcement of Arbitration Agreements. And Article 2 of the New York Convention is the provision that provides the obligation of contracting parties to recognize and enforce agreements to arbitrate. And that's the starting point. And I think that's every bit as important as Article 3 that contains the basic agreement to recognize and enforce arbitral awards. Now, the Hague Convention parallels that process in three articles, 5, 6, and 8. Article 5 is the basic rule that the court chosen in an exclusive choice of court agreement has jurisdiction and shall exercise that jurisdiction. Article 6 tells us that a court not chosen is to defer to the chosen court. And Article 8 tells us then that the resulting judgment shall be recognized and enforced in all contracting states. And then, like the New York Convention, Article 9 of the Hague Convention gives us the basis for non-recognition, the limited basis for non-recognition of a judgment, just as Article 5 of the New York Convention gives us limited basis for non-recognition of an arbitral award. Now, it's important to note that there are, in Article 6, grounds for non-recognition of an arbitration agreement in a court not chosen, and there is no parallel list in the New York Convention, but there is in Article 2 and Article 3. You basically have two grounds for not enforcing an arbitral award. One is in Article 2, and I would suggest you put them together as substantive validity questions, arbitrability and whether it is null and void. And the other is on Article 3. It's a formal validity requirement. It has to be in writing, signed by the parties. The Hague Convention has a very similar formal validity requirement, but it's updated to take into account electronic communications in a way that has created problems for the New York Convention. So the challenges are the problems that were to be solved, and the New York Convention has proved itself incredibly effective in solving the problem of circulation of cross-border, of foreign arbitration agreements and of recognition and enforcement of cross-border arbitration awards. It has significantly changed the environment from one in which courts generally refused to enforce agreements, either choice of court or arbitration, that were seen as ousting a court of jurisdiction, to one in which party autonomy is the prevailing rule.
That's a really good introduction, I think, into our next topic, sort of going into more detail with these two instruments that you outlined for us. So the New York Convention and the Hague Choice of Court Convention, as you mentioned, they were quite revolutionary, dare I say. You kind of touched on their effectiveness, and you talked about the effectiveness of the New York Convention specifically. Could you maybe talk to our listeners a little bit about what are the limitations of these two instruments, or where is further refinement needed to address some emerging complexities in international litigation and arbitration, or perhaps shortcomings of those instruments?
Yeah. Well, the popularity of international arbitration is largely a result of the New York Convention. And if you ask a lawyer, either a contract drafting lawyer, a transactions lawyer, or a dispute resolution lawyer, why parties should choose arbitration, I think the first thing they'll say, some will say confidentiality, some will say, well, you can choose your own arbitrators, but most will, in one of their top two reasons for choosing arbitration, will say, because once we get an award, we can get it recognized and enforced in 172 contracting states. That is quite significant in an international, in a global environment in which parties can easily move assets from one state to another. Because no matter what dispute resolution you choose, the first thing you want to think about before you file either an arbitration or litigation is, well, where, if we win, how do we show the client we have something more than a piece of paper that we can collect on that? And that is important. And both conventions help that. Now, both have limitations, and one of the reasons that was seen for the value of a choice of court convention when we were negotiating it was that international commercial arbitration, although it started out as being considered efficient, cost-effective, and quick, is not always any of those. And many consider it to be quite expensive, and there are a lot of law firms that do nothing but international arbitration, but won't take a case unless it's $5 or $10 million. And so one of my colleagues on the U.S. delegation, when we were negotiating the Choice of Court Convention, referred to it as the convention for middle-class litigants, for those cases in which the costs of arbitration simply are not worth the undertaking. And if you look at the major arbitral institutions and their rules and go to the back and find their fee schedule, you'll often find that it's a whole lot more expensive than litigation. And that brings up something we don't often think about, and certainly we don't teach in law school very much, and that's filing fees. In the United States, you can file a case of any size for in state court or federal court for $300 to $500. In a number of countries, in arbitration, you pay a percentage of the amount in controversy. And if the amount is large, the fee is large to start the case. And that's true in some national courts as well. But filing fees matter. And so when you draft the clause, if you put in arbitration, and then you go to the CEO who says, well, let's go ahead, let's proceed. And you say, well, you know, give us $250,000 so we can file. The CEO says, well, wait a minute, you said this was the best way to go. Why do we need so much money for it? Having said that, choice of court has limitations as well. And the Hague Choice of Court Convention has limitations. The convention, although it's the Convention on Choice of Court Agreements, it's really the Convention on Exclusive Choice of Court Agreements, because you come into the convention scope only if the agreement is an exclusive choice of court agreement. Now, in Article 3, there's a provision that deems every choice of court agreement to be exclusive unless it is clearly stated otherwise. So there's a bit of a presumption there. But in today's complex world, there are lots of industries, trade groups, in which it's believed that litigation may be more appropriate than arbitration, but that exclusive choice of court agreements are not the way to go. We found that out when we surveyed various industries during the negotiation of the Choice of Court Convention, and the banking industry in particular uses, we found, asymmetric choice of court agreements, where the lender can sue in one court and the borrower can sue in another. Under the convention, that's not an exclusive choice of court agreement. But there's logic to having that agreement. Now, it would have been very difficult in the Hague Convention to include rules of jurisdiction, enforcement of the agreement, and at the same time to include exclusive, non-exclusive choice of court agreements that could lead you to various different courts. So the jurisdiction rules are limited to exclusive choice of court agreements and the enforcement of exclusive choice of court agreements. The recognition and enforcement rules generally also are so limited, except that states may declare under Article 22 when they file their instrument of ratification or later that they will honor judgments rendered on the basis of jurisdiction taken as a result of a non-exclusive choice of court agreement, like the asymmetric choice of court agreements used in the banking industry. So far, only Switzerland has opted to file such a declaration. I think that declaration can be very useful. I would hope that as time goes on, all states will do it so that those judgments can circulate as well. But right now, I do see that as a limitation on the choice of court convention. Many see it as a limitation that doesn't mean much because we now have the 2019 Hague Judgments Convention, under which judgments on non-exclusive choice of court agreement cases can circulate. But there are important differences there, not worth going into here because that's beyond what we're discussing. But right now, that's a limitation of the choice of court convention. But beyond that, the limitations are not so much limitations on effectiveness of the convention. I guess the limitation I would suggest today is lack of knowledge. It's easy for lawyers to say, we put in an arbitration clause because of the New York Convention. But the presence of the Hague Convention is going to change that thinking. It's going to require lawyers drafting choice of forum clauses to do a little bit harder work and look at the real balance between arbitration and litigation and choose the one that's right for the transaction that they are helping negotiate.
I think that's really interesting, especially that you mentioned the accessibility of or perhaps inaccessibility due to financial the financial capacities of different stakeholders. And some suggest, or in general during these discussions, mediation also comes up as an alternative dispute resolution mechanism. So let's also bring mediation into this conversation. How do you see the integration of these methods related to mediation within arbitration frameworks? And what are the gaps that still exist there?
Well, yeah, mediation is becoming more and more important. And the advantage of mediation is that it is consensual dispute resolution. Now, you can look at the spectrum of possible dispute resolution, and naturally, in every dispute, we can, I guess, suggest that dispute resolution begins with negotiation, because the parties always have the opportunity together to consensually settle the dispute without the intervention of a third party. Mediation brings in a third party. It brings in an expert at consensual dispute resolution, someone who can help the parties understand what their legal positions really are from a third-party perspective, because often in commercial disputes as well as other disputes, each party kind of gets stuck in their own mindset and their own set of facts, and it's good for them to see it from a third-party perspective before they submit to binding dispute resolution, and that's what mediation offers. And with the Singapore Convention, now having 14 current parties, it has been signed by 43 other states that have not yet ratified or acceded. But it's quickly becoming important. Now, the Singapore Convention is referred to as the Mediation Convention, but it's the Convention on Recognition and Enforcement of Mediated Settlement Agreements. And so it has no jurisdictional similar aspect to it, but has the recognition aspect. Once you have the mediated settlement agreement, to the extent that a party does not comply, that agreement can be taken to another contracting state and enforced, just as we now take arbitration agreements under the New York Convention and are beginning to be able to take judgments under the Choice of Court Convention. When we bring in consensual dispute resolution, like mediation, it brings us back, I think, to the importance of contract drafting. And what we see, and here's where the vis moot, I think, is wonderful. And this year's problem, the 32nd moot problem, is particularly nice because it raises two important questions of contract drafting, one on choice of form and one on choice of law. Interestingly enough, it doesn't require the students or the participants to get into the merits of the case. There is no merits argument to be made. It's only two procedural issues and two applicable law questions. And the both of them arise from questions that highlight important issues of contract drafting and issues that have to do with the choice of form clause, even though one is choice of law in nature. And that is this: once we expand the realm of dispute settlement that's available from negotiation to mediation to arbitration, then the natural question is, well, why do we have to choose just one? Why can't we use a progression from consensual without a third party to consensual with a third party, mediation, to binding third party dispute settlement, which in the vis moot is arbitration? And that makes good sense. So then let's draft the contract, the provision, the choice of forum provision. But it now becomes a choice of fora or forums provision. It's plural. And the vis moot problem raises the question, which is a very practical question and has been raised in the courts and in arbitration, and that is, suppose that you have a tiered dispute resolution clause that goes from negotiation to mediation to arbitration, and one of the parties frustrates the consensual part of the process. In negotiation, that's easy. We can always see that. Negotiations break down all the time. You then move, if you just choose arbitration, directly to arbitration. But if you then have an interim provision for mediation, and one party says, well, this is not even worth mediation because we're so far apart, or just refuses to go to mediation, what does that mean? Is that mediation provision in the agreement, as in the Wismut problem, a mandatory precondition to arbitration, meaning that, and here's the interesting question, does it mean the arbitral tribunal has no jurisdiction, even though you have consent to an arbitration agreement that is formally valid in writing and doesn't violate any substantive validity rules? Can you say the tribunal has no jurisdiction when you've met all those requirements? Or do you say that even though it has jurisdiction, it can't go ahead with the case because mediation is a precondition? And so by trying to solve the problem of allowing non-consensual to move to non-consensual, supervised to move to, or consensual to consensual, supervised to non-consensual dispute resolution, and you say we want to be able to go through that process, you draft the provision. Have you now drafted it in a way that simply creates more problems? It's the law of unintended consequences. Once you try to make things better, what other problems have you created? And once you create a tiered dispute resolution clause, you may have solved some problems by allowing it to be consensual dispute resolution if possible, but have created others by raising questions about what has to happen before you can be legitimately in and before the arbitral tribunal. So those are the kinds of questions that I think really become quite interesting when we add the various stages of consensual dispute resolution with a process that necessarily ends with the opportunity for third-party binding imposed decision. Because you always have to have that out there in event that you don't reach consensus, either through negotiation without a third party or mediation with a third party involved. And so, and the Wismut is wonderful in allowing students to dig into that problem. I will mention, because I had at the outset in answer to your question, the second aspect to this in the Wismut, which is the choice of law clause, which has exactly the same evolutionary context. If you say this contract shall be governed by the law of state X, there are two questions. One is, well, can you use the doctrine of separability to mean that that doesn't apply to an arbitration clause in the same contract? And how do you deal with that? That's an issue. But the issue raised in the Wismut is, well, the law of state X is the whole law of state X, which includes the conflict of laws rules of state X. And given certain sets of facts submitted to the law of state X, you have to always start with the applicable law rules. And the conflicts rules of state X, given the facts, may say, for this problem, we defer to the law of state Y. And then, if you're deferring to the whole law of state Y, the conflicts rules of state Y may say, well, for this problem, we defer to the law of state X, which gets you into the vicious circle of conflict of laws that we call renvoi, or in the U.S., renvoi. And you can't extract from that circle. So when you draft You extract from that circle by saying, this contract shall be governed by the law of state X, to the exclusion of its choice of law rules. So you lead only to the substantive law of state X, and you make that very clear. Now, if the law of state X is the CISG, then you have the question, well, if you've excluded choice of law rules, Article 1 of the CISG is a choice of law rule. Have you excluded Article 1 of the CISG and thereby excluded the entire CISG? Who knows? It's once again, the law of unintended consequences. We've solved the problem of referring only to the whole law of state X by saying the law of state X, only the substantive law of state X. All right? But in doing so, we may well have created other problems. And the Vismut is a wonderful exercise in demonstrating the law of unintended consequences of trying to be more effective in your contract drafting.
That's really interesting that you mentioned it. I'm sure a lot of students will really appreciate your comment on the Vismut. I'm sure a lot of people listening also are working on this problem. So that's a very good point to make.
Yeah, that's also such a crucial point. I mean, so many disputes probably could have been avoided if parties had just been more careful during contract drafting. So on that note, have you ever come across cases where lack of awareness in drafting led to major issues down the line? And from your experience, what are some key things that parties should really focus on when drafting contracts to make sure they don't run into these kind of problems later?
And perhaps to interject here also, maybe if you could mention some of the key elements that parties should prioritize during the stage of contract drafting to ensure a smoother dispute resolution process later on.
Yeah, I think there are, when you refer to practical examples, and this is, I think this applies to this, analyzing the Vismut problem as well. When one party brings a dispute settlement proceeding, whether that's in court or in arbitration, the natural tendency for the lawyers representing the other party, the respondent or the defendant, the natural tendency is to first ask, well, can we just kick this out of the court or the arbitral tribunal? In other words, can we say there is no jurisdiction? Now, in arbitration and in litigation based upon choice of court agreements, jurisdiction is based upon consent. Jurisdiction is based upon contract. So you naturally have to look to the contract. You have to look to the choice of form clause, whether that be choice of court or choice of arbitration. I apologize for the phone ringing in the background. Here's where litigators have to think like transactions lawyers, and transactions lawyers have to think like litigators or dispute resolution lawyers. And so in order to draft a better choice of form clause, you have to ask, well, how can jurisdiction based upon the choice of form be challenged? And I believe, and I've put a lot of thought into this, and I'm just finished up a law review article on it, that there are only five bases on which you can challenge an arbitration agreement, challenge the jurisdiction of an arbitration tribunal, or the jurisdiction of a court based upon issues raised by the choice of court clause. The first of those is the existence of the agreement to arbitrate or the choice of court agreement. That's a contract law question. It's a matter of consent. It's a matter governed by the applicable rules of contract formation, which is always an interesting question as to which rules apply. But It's a gateway question to arbitration. And some courts, including the U.S. Supreme Court, says arbitrators can't decide that. Only the court can decide that. So there's both a what law applies and who decides question on the question of consent, existence of the agreement. The second question is a question of formal validity. And here's one where we can refer back to the New York Convention and the Hague Choice of Court Convention. Each of them has rules on formal validity. Article 2 of the New York Convention requires an agreement in writing signed by the parties or evidenced by an exchange of letters or similar documents. There are similar requirements in the Hague Convention, but it bows to electronic communication and simply requires evidence that is capable of reproduction for purposes of evidence. That's a formal validity requirement. And that's found in arbitration law. It's found in the New York Convention. It's also found in the Uncitral Model Law and other lex arbitri, other national arbitration laws. The third ground for contest of jurisdiction is substantive validity. And that's raised in the New York Convention in Article 2.1 as non-arbitrable, and Article 2.3 as not capable of being performed or null and void. That's substantive validity. But that's a sovereignty question. That's where states come in and say, even though you have consent to go to arbitration, you can't do it because we prohibit it, because we don't allow you to do it. That's different from formal validity. It's substantive validity. The fourth possible challenge is based on scope. Yes, you agreed to arbitrate, but not this issue. The clause says, any breach of this contract shall be submitted to arbitration. Well, you have related issues that are tort questions or otherwise between the same parties but arise out of the same facts. Have you submitted those to arbitration? The fifth question really only comes up more often in litigation, a choice of court, than arbitration, and that is exclusivity. And that's the one I've already discussed in the context of the Hague Choice of Court Convention. So I think in terms of awareness for purposes of contract drafting, lawyers have to be a bit like mechanics. Somebody comes in and says, my car won't run. And you say, well, does it have flat tires? Does the engine start? Does the carburetor work? What does the fuel pump work? Once you get to this point where you know what the problem is, then you can deal with it. Well, as lawyers, we have to boil down that problem to one of those five places where you can challenge jurisdiction. And if you are the lawyer for the client who has been taken to arbitration and you want to challenge jurisdiction, it's much easier to think about it if you think of those five categories and think, what are the arguments? Same thing on litigation. But if you're drafting the contract, you should always ask yourself, have I, to the extent possible, drafted language that will prevent the challenge in each of these five basic ways? I like to think that's a useful context for analysis.
Yeah, it does sound very useful indeed. I mean, five steps to remember. We can call them five car mechanic / lawyer steps. So I really like that metaphor. And staying in the practical realm of things, Professor Brand specifically, I mean, we have already mentioned your extensive credentials, and you've undoubtedly encountered some complex and demanding cases throughout your truly remarkable career. Could you share one of the most challenging or unique experiences that you have faced in a case of arbitration or litigation?
Yeah. Well, I have to put this in the context of my experience. And my experience has not been primarily as an arbitrator or as a counsel in arbitration or litigation, but rather in two different formats. One is treaty negotiations. I've been involved at the Hague Conference since 1992 with the Hague, as a member of the U.S. delegation that created the Choice of Court Convention, the Judgments Convention, and we're now working on a Parallel Proceedings Convention. There are commentators who say that all of those are results of failure because in 2000, 2001, up until that point, we've been trying to negotiate a kind of broader treaty on jurisdiction and recognition of judgments, something like a Brussels regulation for the world. I don't think it was failure at all, because I think we need a clear treaty like the Choice of Court Convention that sits alongside the New York Convention and makes for easy comparison. And I think we have that. And I think that's a huge success. The other realm in which I work is legal education. And through our Center for International Legal Education, we've worked with law schools from more than 50 countries around the world to help prepare for the vismut. We use the vismut problem as I think, the single best pedagogical platform that exists in legal education for students. But much of what I do in that process is work with students who are not from the United States, and that normally means they're not from common law legal systems. And so when we talk about challenges, here's my challenge for law students and young lawyers, and that is the challenge of understanding. And in the legal world, when we're dealing in this realm, we're not dealing with public international law, we're dealing with private international law, international private law, and arbitration included in all of that. The real challenge comes from the different ways in which we think about solving problems. Civil law lawyers think about going directly to the code and understanding that the answer has to always be in the code, either explicitly or through general principles. Common law lawyers may go to a statute but not find the answer, and from there they go to case law. They go to the common law, which we distill by analogy from reading cases. Now, those legal system differences result in legal education system differences. We train lawyers differently in the United States than we do, and England, than lawyers are trained in continental Europe or most of the rest of the world. And we all learn to think about solving problems differently. Now, that difference in legal education system results in different legal thinking. And that different legal system, that different legal thinking results in adjusting our legal systems in a different way. And we get into, again, a circle that we don't get out of. And in the international realm, if you have an international arbitration and one party is from a common law state, another party, the other party is from a civil law state, and you have three arbitrators, two of whom are from civil law states and one from a common law state, counsel and arbitrators are all going to be thinking, they're going to be starting to address the problem in a different way. And so here's my challenge for students, and that is, don't consider yourself done with your legal education until you've studied both in a common law country and a civil law country. Get both. Because what you'll find is you'll understand better. Because then when you draft the contract and the lawyer on the other side trained in a different system, you will understand their language. And when you are arguing a case to an arbitrator who is trained in the other kind of system, you can effectively communicate with that arbitrator. Because what I've found in both the treaty negotiations and in legal education is that we're often talking past each other because we're thinking about solving the problem in different ways. We often come to the same solution, but through a totally different path. But we have to think together in order to create path from problem to solution so that we can make the law work on a global scale, not just within our own legal system. And so I would suggest that in my experience, that's the greatest challenge.
And if I may add, indeed, to what you mentioned, I mean, learning about both types of systems and learning international law, I think really strongly also aligns with our mission. So this is only an encouragement to our audience to indeed explore the world of international law and not just focus on your domestic jurisdiction, but really engage with the globalization that's been affecting everything, including law.
Yeah. This again, I would suggest, is one of the beauties of the VIS moot and the VIS process. What you'll notice, if it's not in the original problem, there will always be, in procedural order number two, clarification of which states are common law states and which states are civil law states. And that's important. And and the students who do the research for the memoranda and the oral argument all have to be able to engage in code-based research, statute-based research, as if it's in a code type system, as well as researching case law. And that's one of the beauties of the VIS moot, is it brings students from all over the world into a realm where they engage in trying to understand better both types of legal systems.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's a really great perspective, as so many of these moots are struggling with these issues for this year's problem. And so that's a great point, especially for those of us looking to build a career in this field. And just to wrap it up, if you had to give one key piece of advice to students and young professionals hoping to work in international arbitration or commercial law, what would it be?
Well, that's kind of a good summary question, because it takes me back to things I've already said. And I'm not going to give one piece of advice. I'm going to give three pieces of advice. And the first one is study in both civil law and common law legal systems. And I'd put in a plug there. If you've studied in the civil law legal system, come to the University of Pittsburgh and do our LLM program. That's my fundamental piece of advice. But my second basic piece of advice is learn to understand, whether you're going to be a litigator or an arbitrator or a transactions lawyer, learn to understand both contract drafting and dispute resolution, because you can't do one well without understanding the other. And finally, we've been focusing on dispute resolution, arbitration, and litigation. And I think you have to realize that functioning and effective dispute resolution systems are fundamental to functioning and effective economic systems within a country or across the globe. You've got to have that. And that does two things. It means that what we do when we study litigation and arbitration has public international law benefits to it. Because you can't deal with applying international rules of human rights unless you're within a functioning economic system. People aren't worried about the human rights. They're worried about food and housing and clothing. But in the end, if you can be better at understanding drafting contracts and resolving disputes, then you can contribute to improving administering those fundamental aspects of the legal system that are absolutely necessary to rule of law, which means that through that process, each person that does that can contribute to rule of law. And that's what I would say that I hope that students and young professionals will think about, that they're not just trying to earn an income or help a client. They're trying to contribute to a better system, nationally, regionally, and ultimately globally, so that we all can live together better.
Well, that's some great advice, I think. And it's been such a great pleasure listening to you today and being able to talk to you, Professor. Thank you so much. Thank you for your incredible insights on litigation, on arbitration, the significance of international law, as well as some commentary on the VIS moot. We've really, really appreciated talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it too, and I wish you all the best.
Well, Professor Brand, this has been such an insightful conversation. Thank you so much for sharing your expertise and experiences with us. I'm sure our audience, especially students and young professionals, will find your insights incredibly valuable. So thank you again, Professor, for taking the time to be here with us. It's been an absolute pleasure. And to everyone listening, we hope you enjoyed this discussion as much as we did. Stay tuned for more conversations on international arbitration and commercial law. Until next time.